Hi, Bob.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You're in Washington, right? I mean, I should say, by way of introduction, I'm Bob Wright of Blogging Heads. And how do you describe yourself these days? You're with the Carnegie Endowment.
I am with the Carnegie Endowment of International Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I get angry notes from people saying, why are you at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace?
Noting the irony of it, you mean?
I don't think it's ironic. I'm interested in peace. Peace through strength, Bob.
Yeah, well... yeah, it's the demonstrations of strength that worry me. But,
oh, okay.
But we'll probably get into some of this.
All right.
Are you excited about the inauguration? I guess you're going to have a harder time getting good seats than you would have if McCain had won.
I think that I can stand on the roof in McLean and see everything just fine. That's my hope, anyway.
So that's working out well enough.
Pardon?
So it's working out well enough for you.
I think
so
it's
far.
Fine as long as I stay away from downtown and just stand on my roof. It's like trying to watch the fireworks from here.
Yeah. Well, actually, I just saw a picture in the newspaper of some Israelis doing that, except it was fireworks of a much more kind of somber sort.
Yeah.
And we
McLean
will talk
is
about,
a good deal safer, I think.
Yeah. We'll talk about that, but maybe we should start off. We'll talk about Gaza, but maybe we should start off with a little Obama talk.
Sure.
I would think you'd be pretty happy with the foreign policy team that's shaping up.
Well, as we discussed last time, I am. I mean, it's a very, I guess the word in Washington is centrist team. There's no sense that we've got a, you know, fundamental paradigm shift in the works, or at least if so, it's not apparent to me yet.
You mean relative to Bush 2, kind of, the last couple of years of Bush?
Relative to the last, you know, three administrations is what I would say.
Wouldn't you say the first part of Bush is really different from the final part of Bush? The final part of Bush had become, more realist, I would say, and less neocon.
Well, whatever. I mean, I don't know what these terms mean exactly. It seems to me that the first term was characterized by 9/11, and the second term was characterized by, you know, maybe trying to achieve something more like a new normalcy, and that a lot of what we saw was a consequence of 9/11. And I've always believed, and I continue to believe, that it wouldn't just have, George W. Bush's response was not necessarily unique to him; that any American president might have made some similar decisions. So, and we'll see. You know, on particularly on some of the controversial issues like, what do you do about detainees, which has been one of the big complaints about Bush, and I myself don't agree with everything that he's done by a long shot, or his administration has done, but it remains to be seen how much of a dramatic change we're going to see in an Obama administration.
Yeah, now here's what my hope would be, which I can assure you will not happen, which is that he would explain to people that, you know, I mean, the background of this is that apparently the people in Guantanamo, the kind of, they divide them up into different categories. And there's this category of some size, not a majority, I think, of people who are, you know, like dangerous terrorists. It would be dangerous to release them. And they are kind of a big part of the problem, right?
Right.
And what I would love is for Obama to say, look, you know, it may be that releasing some people into the world who could conceivably cause us harm, but frankly probably won't when you look at things, reduces the chances of us getting hit over the long haul by terrorists, given what good propaganda this is for terrorist recruiters to have treated them like this in the first place. Now, I think there's no chance that an American president in the current climate would try to deliver a message of such tremendous nuance, although actually you may have noticed it's not that complicated the way I said it, but still, leaving aside for now the question of whether you think the message is true, can you imagine any president trying to say that?
No, because the downside, people are going to weigh which, if you make an error one way or the other, Bob, you know, if you ask the average American which way we should make the error, I think you and I both know what the answer is, and that's part of the problem, obviously.
Yeah, but it seems to me that this speaks like a weird, a kind of weird cognitive distortion that has set in the wake of 9/11, which is that we don't just think of terrorists as kind of worse than regular criminals. We put them in some category of infinite evil. So the thought of letting one terrorist out into the world, no matter how much good might be done, even in terms of reducing future terrorism, it's just kind of unthinkable, and to people, I mean, not to me. And, you know, whereas when you look at the criminal justice system, every year we release from the prison system lots of people who were convicted of violent offenses. We know that at least some of them are going to go out and kill somebody.
Yeah, and Michael Dukakis has a very good memory of that particular
problem. But Bob, surely you would not say that on balance it's serving American interests or American values to keep in prison forever everyone who has been convicted of a violent offense, just because we know that the policy of letting some of them out is going to lead to some bad, right?
You know,
can balance things,
some
right?
Some bad. I mean, you're we're not talking about they're going to go rob a grocery store. And, you know, there have been in the news recently reports about the fact that people have gone, for instance, back to Iraq and carried out a suicide attack. Now, maybe...
No, but let me be clear. I'm saying that these people we release from American prisons, they will kill innocent Americans, will die. They kill people sometimes, and we accept that. So I'm not talking about robbing a grocery store.
Well, we don't accept it when it becomes a public issue. I brought up the Dukakis issue as a kind of a joke, but it also has a serious it had serious implications. And you know, I guess I'd have to say it's easy for you to say that that's what we should do. I think I won't be surprised if President Obama, who I'm sure shares your fundamental outlook on this, decides not to do it in quite the way that you're talking about, and also not to make that case. And there is a problem with the case, Bob, which is that I would say it's in the area of speculation that it increases the risk of terrorist attacks on the United States that we're having carrying out these policies. I do agree that there's certainly... It certainly is harming America's values and, to some extent, America's image in the world. To my mind, the question of violating our own principles is a bigger issue. But it's pretty much speculative on your part that keeping these people in prison increases the chance of terrorism.
Well, it's one of those things that's intrinsically speculative because the way the influence works is so oblique and complicated.
And possibly non-existent.
Possibly, but it's just a question that's not subject to empirical analysis very readily. So the fact that I don't have the hard evidence doesn't say one thing or the other.
I guess
it's one
I
of those things
is,
you're never going to have hard evidence about.
I guess I would say that's your weakest argument. Your strongest argument is that this is a violation of our principles as a nation, and at the end of the day, our principles as a nation is all we've got. I think if you try to make an overly pragmatic case on this, you probably lose. Because if people weigh things in a kind of cold, calculating fashion, I'm not sure they come to the conclusion that you'd like them to come to.
Obama could always make both cases. The second one doesn't hurt.
Well, except then your critics will jump all over the second one. Anyway, it's okay with me what argument you want to make. I do think the issue of principle is a greater substance for us. And as on many past occasions in our history, we're going to have to find the proper balance between upholding our principles and maintaining what we regard as a necessary degree of security. I mean, after all, as you know, we've made these kinds of compromises frequently for ill, but sometimes not necessarily for ill, many times in the course of our history.
Well, of course, I don't accept your premise. You're saying it's a trade-off between our values and our security. The whole point of the argument I'm making is it's win-win. If
well,
you're more
now
consistent
I see why
with our
necessary.
Values, it's
right.
More...
I now I see why it's necessary for you to do that, because you can't be comfortable with an argument between trading off principles for security. It has to be...
No, I might well, if that were all we were talking about, come down on the side of values. I'm just saying I don't think I have to, because in this case it serves both interests, our values and our security.
Well, I think that the latter part is very speculative, and I'm not at all convinced of it, but that's fine.
Okay, but just to get clear on your position on the analogous case... I think you'll probably agree that yes, given how many violent offenders we release on parole, innocent Americans die as a result of our decision not to just have a blanket policy of leaving all violent offenders in prison forever. Are you in favor of this policy of sacrificing innocent American lives?
You know, I'm not an expert on our parole system and how parole decisions are made. My understanding is there is some effort to determine whether we think that this person is likely to commit a crime again or not before we let them out on parole, right?
Right.
And so, you know, if you and I get to sit as the judges of who gets out, and if we were to look at every single person in Guantanamo and sort of individually decide who is likely and who is not likely to commit another crime, it's not just like in the American criminal system, they just say, well, you've served X number of years, now you get parole, right?
No, it's not. I mean, in both cases, there's either an implicit or explicit estimate of the likelihood of repeating the crime.
Right.
My point is that in the domestic case, we don't insist that the probability be zero. We know it's not, and we're not under the illusion that it has to be. Whereas the way people think about terrorism, if you tell them the probability is above zero, that the person will go out and commit a terrorist act, that just sounds different to them from, like, just one American murdering another.
Right, but you are, when you're talking about terrorism, especially these particular kinds of terrorists, you're speaking of a very high magnitude. I think if the parole system of the domestic parole system were based on a principle that we may let this guy out and it may turn out that he may kill 3,000 people in one day, we would have a very high threshold for letting them out.
Do you really think any one of these guys has the capacity to do that or is even likely to get involved in a plot to that?
Well, gee, Bob, I don't know. But I guess I would say that if this were just a case of letting a terrorist out who might commit an individual act of crime, that would be one thing. But the reason we call them terrorists is that they are, in fact, trying to do something much more than that. So the risks are I think it's understandable and correct. That people balance the risks differently than taking an armed robber and putting him back out on the street, right? We don't take mass murderers. We don't take, like, you know, mass murderers. By mass murderers, we mean, like, kill 20 people and have a low threshold of whether to let them out or not. If we let out one of these terrorists and they go off and do a low-level terrorist act, like, say, do a suicide bomb in a market and kill 50 people, that's not a minor action on our...
It's not, but again, on the domestic front, I guarantee you that our policy of not just keeping them all in prison has led to the death of more than 50 innocent Americans over the years. It's something we accept.
Right, but I guess all I would say, Bob, is this isn't there's no absolute in either direction, right? I mean, in both cases... And certainly in our domestic parole system, we weigh the possible costs against the benefits of not keeping people in prison, you know, at the maximum amount of time. And I'm sure that we must recalculate those costs based on experience and, you know, and what we can figure out. It's not just a matter of, we have a principle of not keeping people in jail for any longer than necessary. We weigh these we make these balanced judgments, and we'll do the same thing with regard to these terrorists.
Right. I mean, of course, here you see where it matters which paradigm you buy into. If you accept my premise that you call speculative, that on the other side of the scale is a bunch of terrorism that will happen because of the what Guantanamo does for recruiting, then the magnitude you're talking about evens out. On both sides.
If you could come up with a more persuasive case that keeping people in Guantanamo marginally increases the risk of terrorist attack, right? Then that would have to go into the balance. But I just think that you're going to have a at the moment at least a very hard time persuading anybody that is more than just a speculation on your part. I mean, there are other costs that are measurable. There's costs in terms of world opinion regarding the United States. There's costs in terms of allied public opinion in terms of working with the United States that are measurable. I've yet to see any kind of study, serious or otherwise, that suggests this is somehow increasing terrorism.
I don't know if those are measurable in the ultimate sense. You could do the public opinion polls, but measuring the damage they do. Anyway, I'm definitely not going to convince you.
Well, and I'm not going to convince you either, I guess.
There's a chance that both of those things are true, yes. So what else should we talk about? I mean, you sounded alarmed that Obama was going to evince respect towards someone in your email. Am I caricaturing your view?
No, I wasn't alarmed. You always have to put it that way. I'm not alarmed. I'm very calm and collected and looking at all these things analytically. So it's not a question of – it's not an emotional response. My question is is Iran looking for respect? Is that if Americans give them some kind of rhetorical respect, is that going to affect their decision making about their nuclear weapons program? And I guess I have to put myself down as skeptical in that regard. By the way, let me just preface all this so that we could skip through the stereotypes. I'm in favor of negotiating with Iran. I wrote a column calling for negotiations with Iran last year. And I think that the Obama administration is right to make that attempt. But on this specific question of whether the problem between us and Iran is that they somehow think we don't respect them, I guess I'm skeptical of that.
Well, I wouldn't say that by and large, the problem with Iran is low self-esteem. No, I actually do think there is a sense of disrespect. I think in some places it hurts us very badly. I think among Palestinians there's a sense of disrespect that's a little more volatile than possibly in Iran. I do think as a matter of, if you're going to talk to somebody and you're going to try to get something done, you might as well show respect while you're doing it. I think that. I would not say that in the case of Iran, a sense of disrespect is the fundamental problem, but I haven't thought it through. So anyway, this all started with Obama's saying that he was going to approach Iran with a new respect. And then Hillary Clinton said stuff more or less consistent with this in her Senate testimony yesterday, I guess.
Well, she said that she has that line about how she wants Iran to be a, respected and respectable and constructive regional player, mm-hmm. which I think some people might take as, how much of a regional player do we want Iran actually to be? But I suppose if they're going to be a constructive regional player, that would be a good thing. I don't have much, that seems to me to be normal kind of opening gambit. It's a little like this little trick we've played on the Chinese by asking them to be a responsible stakeholder, which usually means, could you please do all the things that we would like you to do? So I don't mind that kind of gambit. Yes, we would like Iran to be a constructive regional player. I don't have a problem with that kind of opening gambit, especially if it's, put together with a lot of the bottom lines, which Obama has made it clear that we do have bottom lines. And I think that's what's, that's how it mitigates against whatever the respect issue is, including in Iranian eyes. I wonder when the Iranians finish reading everything that the Clinton administration has said, whether they really feel like, wow, we have a great opportunity with a brand new outlook in the United States, or whether they really just see more of the same.
Good question. And I certainly don't know the answer to that. What is your idea of what should we put on the table with Iran if you think we should talk?
Well, what's on the table has always been evident, I think, to everyone. If Iran, brings its nuclear development program under some kind of international management in such a way as to give people confidence that they're not going to be creating a nuclear weapon, and if they cease to support terrorism or support violence in the Middle East, then I think that the door is open to full integration into the international economy and recognition and all the good things that come with being part of our modern liberal capitalist world. I think that deal has always been there, and I think, I think probably people will want to say, and some promise not to attack or invade them for whatever that's worth to them.
And do you think that's likely to work?
Do I think they're likely to agree to this?
Yeah.
No.
And do you think we should bomb them, or somebody should, if it doesn't work?
No, I'm not. I'm very worried about the bombing option. I'm not sure what we can necessarily accomplish.
But if they get a bomb, you face the real prospect of a regional arms race, right?
A very real prospect. In fact, Saudis and other Gulf states have already made their necessary contacts with various potential nuclear weapons suppliers.
And in fact, bombing is hardly really a solution to that problem, right? It's not like the Saudis are going to burn their records of the phone numbers of these contacts.
Well, it is important, I think, that I wouldn't make too little of the distinction between thinking about getting a bomb and getting a bomb. There have been many countries around the world that have, like Japan, for instance, South Korea, that have the capacity to build a bomb if they want to, but have foregone that option. I think that's significant. There's a difference, right? So mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia knowing how to do it, knowing how to get it, and getting it are two very, very different things.
But it seems like what we need is a true regional agreement featuring intrusive inspection. So this leads to my crazy idea, which I'm sure you'll shoot down, but I think it would be in Israel's interest to say, okay, it's no secret, we have nukes, and frankly, we feel too imperiled to give them up anytime soon. On the other hand, we hope not to use them. We think it's in everyone's interest not to start an arms race, and we would put up with X, Y, and Z. We would even, as a token gesture, decommission some, a dozen or something. They've supposedly got like a couple hundred, and We would put up with inspections to ensure we're not building new ones, and we would, if this thing unfolds on schedule, and so, you know, 5 years from now we have actual inspections of all these countries and blah, 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 then we would condition X more, decommission X more. In other words, it would be somewhat analogous to the NPT, where the power that has the nukes says we'll make a good faith effort on this timetable to slowly become a nation without nukes in exchange for the assurance that blah, blah, blah. Now, what do you hate about this?
You know, I don't hate anything about it in particular other than anybody imagining that any of these countries are actually going to rid themselves of nukes anytime in our lifetime. But
well, none of them have nukes right now with the possible
exception
of Iran. Oh, I'm
sorry. I thought you were talking about existing NPT
members. I'm talking regional. So you get the countries that don't have them yet, plus Iran, which may or may not, to submit to these inspections, and in exchange, Israel kind of fesses up. I'm seeing this kind of cast as, you have to swallow the fact that this might be cast as a diplomatic triumph for Iran.
Yeah.
And you got to swallow that as the price for really intrusive inspections, truly intrusive inspections.
On Israel?
What's that?
On Israel?
Well, not inspections yes, Israel has nukes. The inspections would determine that no new ones were being made, that a certain number got decommissioned.
I want to make sure I understand you. Are you saying that Iran, in return for foregoing its own nuclear program, gets this kind of inspection of Israeli programs?
Well, it would be an international inspectorate.
Right, I don't think Iran would go for that, because the fact of Israel having nuclear weapons is sufficient for them. I don't think they care whether it's monitored or not. And they have all kinds of reasons, independent of Israel, why they want to have a nuclear weapon.
Okay, but then
significantly independent of Israel, I might add.
Well, they're independent of everything else too, probably. But my point is, this would be a harder. There would be a lot of pressure on Iran in the region, I think, to swallow this. It would be a kind of triumph for them if they did swallow it. And then finally, I would just say, Israel, if they're going to eventually bomb Iran, they will be in much better shape having made what looks like a good faith effort to head the thing off peacefully.
You know, I've never studied the issue of why Israel doesn't acknowledge what everybody assumes to be true. And there may be very good reasons why they haven't that I'm not thinking of, okay? So I don't want to rush to just say, yeah, they should just declare themselves a nuclear weapons state. I mean, for one thing, in the present state of international opinion with regard to Israel, are you sure that wouldn't lead to just a kind of crushing international attack on Israel?
You mean attack?
I don't mean literally military
opinion.
Attack, but yeah. Potentially, you know, economic attack. I mean, I'm not sure that.
Oh gosh, but everybody knows.
I know.
Everybody knows where the reactor is. It's in Dimona.
Yeah, I got that. But you know, it is amazing in human life, as I'm sure you know it from. We all have this in personal experience. Knowing something 99% and then knowing it 100% seems to have a huge psychological difference for people. I'm not sure what the consequences for Israel would be.
Well, I think the fear, the valid fear, is that maybe Arab states, maybe Iran, would try to turn it into a PR triumph. I don't think you have to worry about Europe saying, oh my gosh, they've got nukes,
Don't tell me I don't have to worry about Europe when it comes to Israel. I've lived in Europe for many years. I know what their attitude is, so I'm not sure that that's true. But look, let's skip that issue, okay, because I don't know what the answer is.
Mm-hmm.
The real question would be, would this actually help produce the outcome in Iran that we want? And of that, I'm highly skeptical, because turn it around. Now let's say Israel's publicly announced that it has X number of weapons, and therefore Iran says, yeah, and that's exactly when we don't get to have one. I mean, you know, I'm not sure that weakens the Iranian position. In world opinion, which is what you're talking about, let's not forget, you're talking about the world now coming down on Iran hard because Israel has done this. Maybe that wouldn't be what would happen.
On the other hand, you got to realize that's what they're thinking now.
Who?
And yet, Iran, they're thinking, wait a second, Israel's got 200 nukes.
Yeah, I know that's what they're thinking, and they'll continue thinking it. And the fact that Israel's going to reduce, you know, by 10 missiles or 10 warheads every year for the next 30 years is not going to make Iran feel any better.
I would say, I think for you to think there would be an adverse reaction like in Europe and elsewhere is the opposite of the truth. I think Israel would be lauded for this, and that would in turn put pressure on Iran and make it easier to amass sanctions against Iran. But it's pretty speculative. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm just saying, you know, I'm not comfortable bombing them until you've exhausted a whole lot of creative
searches. Well, that's an interesting question, Bob. Are you in favor of bombing them if you've exhausted everything?
Well, it's kind of too late to do everything that I thought should have been done, you know? I
mean, well, in principle...
Because you would have started much earlier. I mean, if we start in earnest now, we're starting a little
late.
Well,
I actually agree with you, which is why I called for these negotiations a year ago, and probably could have called for them 3 years ago. But in principle, if we had gone through... This is now we're moving away from the specific case here. In principle, if we had gone through whatever you consider to be a serious effort to get other kinds of arrangements, would you be in favor of bombing them?
Well, I guess probably not. And the reason, one big reason is, you just have to address the issue of places like Israel and India, where we say, I mean, we have to at least address the issue. And, of course, I know what kind of the answer is. The Iranian government is behaving in a crazier fashion than the Israeli and Indian governments. I'm a little uncomfortable with that just because, you know, craziness is a matter of perspective. You know, to you and me, it certainly seems like that. But, you know, I'm just big on having international standards, you know.
Well, I get it. I mean, look, the NPT has always been a monstrous double standard, right? I mean, there's no justice to the NPT from the beginning, right?
Right, but it was at least agreed. Some of the double standard was agreed upon by everyone at the beginning. That is to say, the people who had nukes back then got to keep them. That was the deal.
Well, that
India
was six,
and Israel didn't.
That was how many? What was that? Five powers out of all the nations in the world?
Yeah, whatever.
They all agreed, all five of them.
Well, no. But a bunch of the other nations that signed on to the NPT accepted.
Right,
that.
But I guess what I'm saying is, if you get into the business of saying why shouldn't Iran, because they're just because we think they're crazy, why shouldn't India, why shouldn't Pakistan, why shouldn't Saudi Arabia, why shouldn't Japan, why shouldn't South Korea? You know what I mean? Where does that argument end exactly? It ends with 50 nuclear powers, right?
Well, it does, which is the question of why should you say yes to India and Israel in the first place?
Well, right, and you wind up saying yes not because...
And Pakistan.
I mean, unfortunately, and here now we can get into our, you know, favorite metaphysical conversation, you wind up saying yes not because justice tells you you should say yes or justice tells you you should say no. You wind up saying yes for a variety of reasons that mostly have to do with the prejudices of where you live. I mean, interests, values start coming into play at that point, and then you have an unfair system.
Right. Well, as soon as you let anybody cross the line, that's the world you're in.
That's
right. What I'm saying. That's my line.
Well, right, but we've already...
Once you say yes to Pakistan and India and Israel, then you're in the territory you just described.
Right, which is the territory that I think is inescapably the territory.
Well, no. No. It is because America... basically says it's okay for our friends to break the rules and not for our enemies, rather
not
than
just,
say, here are the rules.
Not just America in all cases, but...
Well, no, people are prone to this, you're right, but it's something that it's in our interest to transcend, I think.
Well, it may not be in our... if it's in our interest to do it, then it's not in our interest to transcend it.
No, it's in our interest to enforce global rules that constrain people, in some cases, ourselves. I mean, the NPT is an odd example in the sense that the Big Five or whatever were grandfathered in. But I think in other cases, we should be exactly as constrained as everyone else.
But everyone else isn't constrained. I mean, Pakistan got a weapon because China was willing to help it get a weapon. And, you know, that's what... And then we kind of have now played, run interference for India. We're also responsible for some of our major allies not getting nuclear weapons, I think, which is to our credit. India sort of did this without anybody's permission, but we sort of let it happen, right?
Yeah.
And codified it.
Well, we codified it again very recently,
right.
Which I was against.
Right. A lot of times you could say, look, what choice do we have? And that may be the real reality, which is that everybody gets to have nuclear weapons who really wants them. Because the truth is... We can convince people voluntarily to give them up. We've never convinced anybody who didn't want to be convinced.
Well, almost by definition. I mean, being convinced is to choose, you know, that to have been convinced.
Right,
I mean,
then you'd have to, you know, then you'd have to say, well, then the punishments have to be sufficiently severe that people won't make that decision. But, you know, in North Korea, the punishments have been pretty severe.
Well, it can be carrots. I mean, and what's the difference in a certain sense? With South Africa, they gave up weapons,
right.
Nuclear weapons, and... You know, the difference between a carrot and a stick isn't as clear-cut as people.
Well,
sanctions, escaping existing sanctions is a carrot.
In most
know?
Cases where countries have given up nuclear weapons, the majority of cases have been nations that lived under the American security umbrella. and therefore felt that we would guarantee their security even if they gave up their nuclear weapons. I mean, that therefore, unfortunately, means that those are only the people who are on your side. The people who think of you as a threat are not susceptible to that kind of persuasion.
Well, you could say that everyone needs to be placed under someone's security umbrella.
They have their own nuclear weapons, right?
Yeah, well, Israel is, in effect, under our umbrella.
Yeah.
I mean, Iran, in a way, is a dicier case, unless you want to say Russia could officially adopt
No, I think Iran doesn't feel like they're under anybody's security umbrella, which is one reason they want a nuclear weapon.
Right. So you're in favor of it, then.
Pardon?
No, I'm kidding. But you see their point of view.
Of course, I see their point of view. You know, I always see everybody has a point of view, and you know, this is the thing that sometimes is so paralyzing for Americans in particular is that when they sometimes they go a long way. Americans thinking that nope, the other guy doesn't have a point of view, right? The other guy is just Hitler or whatever. And then when somebody tells them that the other guy does have a point of view, then there's this great, you know, moral confusion all of a sudden. Now we don't know what to do. The other guy has an argument too. You know.
Yeah. But, well, I would say. If that's not true of you, then maybe you shouldn't be called a neocon. And I don't even know if you're still wearing the label proudly or willingly at all.
I've never worn the label willingly.
Well, but come on. Before, 10 years ago, when people said you and the Weekly Standard were neoconservatives, and it had no special taint before the Iraq War, you were not going around asking people not to call you that, were you?
Well, I didn't agree with the term because then I knew what an actual neoconservative was, and I couldn't be a neoconservative in the true meaning of the term, which was that I was once on the left and then I was on the right.
But I think at some point that has to cease to be part of the definition.
At some point that did cease to be part of it, and mostly people didn't call me a neocon in the 1990s. They only started calling me a neocon after the Iraq War.
Yeah, well.
So, and then it meant, like, I don't know, well, I don't, it could mean a number of things. But
I do think that what I think of as fairly maybe hardcore neoconservatism is actually characterized by an inability or unwillingness to see the point of view of people on the other side.
I would say that there's a much broader spectrum of Americans who are guilty of that as well. I mean, there is a certain kind of, I wonder whether you'd agree with this, there's a certain kind of liberal internationalist that doesn't recognize that the liberal internationalism they're promoting in and of itself is not necessarily something that another country wants to embrace. Right? I mean, you know, and we did a lot of, in the Clinton administration, I remember a great deal of this from, you know, some of our finest liberal internationalists, a lot of explaining to other countries what their interests really are.
No, I agree. I would call myself a progressive realist. And I don't think we should be in the business of lecturing other countries about, you know, well, a lot of things. The other thing is, I think it tends not to help. I mean, I think, and I guess we disagree here, but I think countries that you would not say are characterized by, modernity in our sense of the word, tend to be moving in that direction. I was in Saudi Arabia a few months ago, and I see forces at work that I think are, if slowly, moving them toward values that are closer to, say, feminism. And I think if you go in and preach to them, you, if anything, retard the process, personally.
Well, I don't think anybody, you know, preaching is one thing. I mean, you know, what I'm talking about is you go to Russia and you say, look, it's in your interest to let X, Y, and Z happen because these are your greater interests. And we do the same thing with Iran. It's really in their interest to give up the nuclear weapon and join the liberal international order, et cetera. We say that to China. That's what I'm talking about. In terms of what kind of society a nation should become, I don't think we don't do that much. Well, maybe we do. But I think the biggest influence is just, you know, modernity itself, which some people fight against, but it's usually a losing battle. But there's more than one kind of modernity is what I think we're discovering, right?
Right. But I think, you know, you're professing a willingness to see the other person's point of view. I think some people would say that your history of depicting, say, China and Russia is really not entirely characterized by that.
Bob, there's a separation here, and I don't really. You must not have actually read what I've written on these countries, because
possible.
I always talk about what their point of view is, and I guess the difference is knowing what their point of view is not the end of the discussion. The fact that they have a point of view and they even have a legitimate point of view does not actually answer policy questions necessarily, because in the unfortunately, continuing anarchic international system. Everybody has a point of view, but you know, somebody's got to be shaping the system. Either you're shaping it or they're shaping it.
Or both.
More likely both, but it's a competitive shaping. So it's not as if, you know, understanding what their point of view is necessarily, you know, it should inform your policies, but it doesn't tell you what those policies should be.
Right. But to the extent, though, that it's predictive, it might inform them. You know, in other words, if you look at Russia and say, well, given the whole history of the Cold War, you know, if we expand NATO at a fairly brisk pace, and then if they say to us, look, it's really, really like a problem if you include Georgia, and we just look at the situation and say, yeah, actually, probably for Putin, it is a little bit of a public relations problem with his, he does pay an internal political price for us doing things that seem to be infringing on their traditional turf. I mean, remember, Georgia was once part of the Soviet Union.
So was Ukraine.
Yeah, and
so were the Baltic states.
Right, but it allows you to predict that, you know, well, maybe if you keep, you know, if you overplay that hand, you're going to get serious blowback that's not in anybody's interest, which I would say is what happened.
Right, but then you could also say that if Putin's goal now, which is a relatively, it's relatively new goal, new as in the last 5 or 6 years, is to reestablish Russian primacy in the former Russian Empire. You could say, yeah, that's what he wants to do, but we really shouldn't let him do that.
No, we shouldn't, do that. But
and we did have to. I mean, Georgia was a sovereign country,
right?
Recognized as sovereign by Russia, and wanted to be part of the Western world and part of the Western part of the EU and part of NATO. Russia then says, no, we don't want them to. Then we are faced with a choice.
Yeah.
Now, one option is to appease, and I mean that, and I want to use that word in its actual meaning, as opposed to the loading, mm-hmm. you know, everybody mm-hmm. can't use that word because it's an insult, but mm-hmm. appease is correct in this case,
mm-hmm.
Russian sensibilities, or you could say, no, that's not the kind of world I want to live in now. I don't want to live in a world where Russia gets to reassert its control over Georgia and Ukraine and
You don't want to live in a world in which powerful countries have spheres of influence, which has always been the world
we
live in.
No, I don't want to live in a world where Russia's sphere of influence includes the now sovereign nations of Georgia, Ukraine, and the Baltic states. I mean, of course nations have spheres of influence, but should everybody get whatever sphere of influence they want? See, now we're back to a situation where it's not just again, right? Now we're back to a situation where we want what we want, and we don't want them to have what they want.
But nobody was talking about them, like, invading Georgia. I mean, that's finally happened.
Except that that's what they
finally
did.
Happened because we misplayed our hand. But in terms of what they were asking in exchange for it not getting out of hand, it wasn't anything like surrendering Georgia's sovereignty to them. Now, there was a secessionist republic or two in which apparently the people actually wanted to secede on balance.
I think over time, I
was not even intrinsically in favor of that. I was just arguing for consistency. If we're gonna let Kosovo succeed, even though a lot of people don't want that to happen, then you should have the corresponding situation over there. You should do it one way or the other.
Well, I know the secession discussion is something that you're dying to have again, but before we get to that, I do think that the sovereignty of Georgia and the sovereignty of Ukraine are, in fact, at stake here, even if it's short of an all-out Russian invasion. I do think sovereignty is what is at issue. I think that the goal of Putin right now is to have control and thereby deprive Georgia and Ukraine of real sovereignty.
I don't think that was in the slightest. Greater Georgia's sovereignty was in the slightest at risk. I mean, it might be that as part of the deal with Russia, we did not extend a NATO invitation to them. But if we don't extend it to them, then their sovereignty has not been infringed on a bit. They just didn't get the invitation.
Well,
that kind of stuff happens in the real world of geopolitics all the time.
Right, and in the real world of geopolitics, not extending the invitation could well lead, and I think would lead, and I think, you know, if we don't do the right things, will lead, to Georgia gradually losing its sovereignty and coming under the control of Moscow. Yes, that's what I think will happen. And so,
there I totally disagree.
Okay.
But I did want to ask, do you think there should be, ideally, some internationally accepted standard for ratifying secession?
I don't think there can be a set of rules that tells you what to do. I just don't see how you could come up with a set of rules like that. You could. The only two rules you could have are recognize them all or recognize none of them. I don't think either of those is tenable.
Well, no, you could have a body, like the Security Council or like whatever, create a new body that is in charge of ratifying them and making decisions on a case-by-case basis.
It was actually pursuant to a UN resolution and UN agreement in 1999, the entire negotiating process that ultimately led to the plan by the, I guess now Nobel Prize-winning Marty Ahtisaari, that was going to lead to what was going to be a so-called supervised independence of Kosovo, all subject to the UN process, which ultimately Russia decided that it didn't want to support. I mean, it isn't as if...
Well, but the Security Council did not validate the secession, right?
Well, the Security Council couldn't because Russia ultimately objected, but it was under UN auspices and pursuant to a UN resolution in 1999 that the entire unfolding of the process of negotiating a status for Kosovo unfolded, and it was a UN-appointed official, Marty Ahtisaari, who came up with a plan, which was backed by Ban Ki-moon and most members of the Security Council. So, you can't claim that this was... I mean...
You're not in favor of doing everything that most members of the Security Council want as a rule, right?
No, but I'm not the one claiming that the Security Council is the only authorized... You know, if you want to claim...
But I'm saying the Security Council per se, the way it's designed to function, where, for better or worse, there is now a veto.
Right, but so what I'm saying is it's not as if Kosovo occurred in a vacuum. It occurred under UN auspices, except right up until the point where Russia refused to go along.
Right. One thought I would want to put in your head that occurred to me after the last conversation is just that, look, the Security Council is far from my ideal body.
Yeah.
It's just like what we have right now. It's not the body I would design to do this. But, you know, if you do the thought experiment, if it actually were the widely respected body for doing this kind of thing, what you wind up there is you get people using it to do horse trading, and you can imagine a scenario where we say, we really want Kosovo, and Russia says, we really want Ossetia, and you do the deal. Now, I'm just wondering, would you have been opposed by the peaceful, orderly secession of Ossetia, where apparently most of the people wanted it, combined with the peaceful secession of Kosovo, and it had this validation, and nobody got killed. Would that have been okay?
Well, as I said to you last time, I mean, there was a process for dealing with Ossetia and Abkhazia that would have had the same kind of international involvement that occurred in Kosovo, and the lengthy negotiations that produced the answer in Kosovo that Marty Ahtisaari and others came up with. But that's not what happened, obviously. So,
well, but again, there was nothing internationally recognized, really, about it. I mean, just as a thought experiment, would you be opposed to the Security Council having mediated that particular horse swap?
I would, because the same ability to come up with a negotiated solution would have applied, and I am willing to live with it. That doesn't mean that I think the UN Security Council can answer every problem, and I'm not sure that it would have been able to answer the Georgia problem either, really. It might have come up with the same exact stalemate that we wound up having in Kosovo.
Okay, but wait, I want to be clear. You're saying in the thought experiment, you could live with the outcome of that thought experiment?
I think in thought experiments, I can live with almost anything.
Okay, so you could live with that. Good.
In thought experiments, yeah.
Okay. Well,
in the real world, it's a little more complicated.
Well, everything I believe exists in a totally platonic universe, as you know.
Well, okay. Yeah.
So
you live
so
in a
I
noumenal
guess,
universe.
In the noumenal universe.
As opposed to a phenomenon.
Yes. I was thinking...
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
I was thinking numinous for a second. Yeah. There's a related word. Never mind. In this book, The Idea of the Holy.
Mm.
But I digress.
Okay.
But of course, we cannot leave this without, I guess, discussing Gaza a little. I actually don't know what you'll say about this.
Mm.
You can guess probably much of what I will say about it. But what are you saying about it?
Well, you're always in peril trying to understand what the Israelis have in mind, and therefore to judge what is going to work and what's not going to work, because you have this very strange situation where clearly the Israeli government is sort of at odds with itself over how far it wants to go. I do think that the proper settlement is one where some form of international supervision prevents Hamas from putting itself in a position once again to fire rockets at Israel. And ideally, I would hope that Hamas would be severely weakened by this whole event, and that you have a chance at some kind of alternative leadership. I mean, I guess it's in my thought experiment, Fatah would come in and be stronger in Gaza and potentially run it. But I don't know if that thought experiment has any basis in reality either.
No, I'm skeptical. I don't know enough to say. I'm a little skeptical. So you think it could well be that what Israel's doing is in its interest?
Well, I mean, certainly in the limited sense that I think that, you know, any nation would find it intolerable to have hundreds of rockets raining down on it all the time and would want to do something about it. I also think that Hamas is a particular kind of, you know, their willingness to move in the direction that now the West Bank leadership is willing to move in, which is a proper two-state solution, is practically negligible. I don't know. Did you happen to read the op-ed by Jeffrey Goldberg in the New York Times?
I did read it.
What did you think of that?
Well, first of all, I should say my history with Jeffrey Goldberg precludes me from having an objective view of anything
because
you write.
Because you like him or you have problems?
Well, Jeffrey and I have a little bit of an issue about something he said in the course of a written exchange between me and him prior to the Iraq War, in which I opposed it, and he favored it. It's a long story. It was not a nice innuendo he was trying to cast in my direction. But
he's
leaving that
nice
aside,
person.
What's that?
He's a very nice person.
Oh, all my enemies are. That's what's so frustrating.
Oh, okay.
Except toward me. I mean, that's why I call them enemies. No, I thought the problem was that was this kind of essentialism. I mean, basically, he quoted a bunch of Hamas people saying crazy things.
Leaders.
Yeah, leaders. And saying crazy, kind of, I guess, anti-Semitic or you know, and go, and basically it's like, see, Hamas can never change. I just have a different view of the way organizations work.
Yeah, well,
he has a kind of essentialism about Hamas. I think over time organizations can do 180-degree turnarounds, personnel can change, and individual people.
Well, there's a chance we may find agreement. It may be elusive, but I'm going to try for it, okay? The sentence that I disagreed with in that piece, which I thought was otherwise quite excellent, was people don't change their beliefs because they've been attacked or by force. And actually, history suggests otherwise, right? I mean, beliefs do die as a result of losing conflicts. The South, for instance, believed in slavery and then was forced to stop believing it. So I just wonder whether, you know, actions can have consequences. And now I'll direct you to another New York Times columnist, and I was wondering whether you read Tom Friedman's piece on this subject.
I did, and
do you have a bad relationship with Tom too?
No, actually, I like Tom. We have a good relationship.
He never would send you a nasty note, so.
No. Our worldviews are largely consonant, I think. I'm trying to remember. He started out, are they trying to educate Hamas? And well, his view was, I guess, his view was Hamas is educable. It's hopeless. I think he thinks it's hopeless to try to destroy it.
Right, but he felt they're educable by force was the implication, I thought, of his piece.
Right. I think that can happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is such thing as negative feedback that works, but negative reinforcement, you might say. I just think that in this case, it doesn't make sense. I mean, I think you just have to consider all the other factors. And let me start out by saying, look, if I were in Israel, you know, even though the rockets have not killed many people at all, you know, I'd be extremely uneasy. And as a practical matter, the government has got to do something as a political matter.
Yeah.
You know, if it wants to get reelected, they do have an election coming. That's not the same as saying that doing this particular thing is in the interests of Israel long term.
Well, here you are telling Israel what its interests are. I thought you're not in that business.
No, I'm totally in the business of telling countries and people, what is in their interest?
Oh.
Would you like to know what's in your interest, Bob? I'd be happy to spend a few minutes counseling.
Well, we should do that off camera, okay?
Okay, I do it all the time because I actually think Israel's interests and America's interests are largely aligned, and my gripe is
my God, have you talked to Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer about that?
You know, it's funny. My critique of their paper was, there were two critiques I made on Blogging Heads. One of them was that there was actually an internal contradiction in the paper. Because they start out talking as if, you can't serve Israel's interests and America's interests. And then at the tail end, they actually do acknowledge, if you read the paper, that their interests are largely, or what they say is this policy isn't serving Israel either. So to that extent, they were acknowledging a correlation of interests. And that was one of my big critiques of them. And I actually think in the book, they probably moved in the direction I would have had them move, which is to acknowledge a correlation of interests. Look, for Israel to solve its security problem is deeply in our interests and obviously in their interests. Okay? And whereas for it to stay in a state of, you know, constant embattlement is not in anybody's interest,
well,
it seems to me.
Fair enough, except that it's not entirely up to them whether they stay in a state of constant embattlement, as Hamas's behavior demonstrates.
No, and look, if you ask me to do strategizing for the Palestinians and tell them what they've done wrong over the last 20 years, I'd be happy to do that. I just don't think that American policy has much direct influence over that.
Well, I mean, it does in some ways. I mean, and this is where, you know, people could come in and maybe want to criticize Condi Rice, because I would suppose that if you believed that Hamas was educable, one element of the education would be their perception that the world is not actually going to try to help them in this situation.
Yeah. I mean, education is not quite the way I would look
at it.
Well,
that's a nasty word for what's obviously going on.
But I would say even when you're talking about the positive reinforcement side, for example, I think once they won the election and we had said it's fine for you to participate in the election, best thing to do was say, okay, you won. And I think at that point there would have been a real chance of weaning them away from terrorism. And this is grounded ultimately not in some view of education so much as in a cynical kind of view of human behavior. In other words, once you show people the fruits of being part of the establishment, part of the system, you know, you show their elites, isn't it nice to, you know, you give them all the positive feedback, you give them trade, you give them, you know, and then their leaders get to be wined and dined. I think people are very malleable, and I wouldn't call that education.
Well, I know, and look, I'm if anything, I would have been more on your side in believing that letting them win an election and then giving them the legitimacy to an election provides would have a positive impact on them. I must say, events don't exactly support my hope in that regard.
Well, we didn't do the experiment. We don't know.
Well, I mean, we did the experiment in some respect. It's just that, I mean, look, setting aside what we did or didn't do, I think we do have to entertain, at least to some degree, the possibility that some important Hamas leaders and perhaps majority of Hamas followers are in some fundamental way irreconcilable to the existence of the state of Israel, at least
some,
in the near term.
Some leaders probably are in the near term, and I think, the goal is to give them less and less power within Hamas and give the moderates more and more, and I think that, you know, the path to that is, you know, first of all, an actually solid, like, one-year truce. And, you know, there has been talk, I think, among moderates in Hamas of, like, you know, in Islamic law, the term is hudna, I guess, right, for truce. I think there's been talk of, like, a 10-year hudna or 15 or 20, something, you know, long term. And I think if you could actually get that, you've got a lot of time to work with. You could do a complete transformation. Now, I'm not saying it's easy to get that, but I'm saying you can see the rhetoric of the moderates lays out kind of what rhetorical path you would want them to walk down. And look, it's obviously become less likely lately, and I think the Israeli attack has made it less likely. But I do think it's not quite impossible, and I think it was much more likely after they won the election we encouraged them to participate in.
Well, now you're not in the thought experiment. Now you're just it's contrary to fact. I mean, Israel withdrew from Gaza. They had a ceasefire. Israel... And then they broke the ceasefire. I mean,
but wait! I got a couple of quibbles here. First of all, withdrawing from Gaza, I'm among those who think that should have been negotiated in a way that empowered Fatah. Okay, that made Fatah look responsible for the.
Well, neither
withdrawal.
You nor I. There are people who would know whether that really was a realistic possibility or not.
Okay, but leaving that aside, withdrawing unilaterally and then continuing to control the borders is not the same as actually making them the legitimate government of what is treated in many ways as an actual state, okay? And secondly, as far as who violated the ceasefire, I mean, you know that's a long argument. I mean, Matt Iglesias on his blog linked to this thing from November where apparently the ceasefire had been holding recently, and then Israel went in and killed some Palestinians. Now, Israel's story is, well, we found this tunnel that we think they were going to use for X, Y, and Z. But that was apparently a big moment in the deterioration of the ceasefire. So, you know, and there's, you know, and Hamas's argument is that, you know, Israel was supposed to, you know, the control of the borders was contrary to this. Look, I don't know.
Well, look,
about
I think that,
argument,
most people that, you know, and including the new people who are going to be making policy in the Clinton, in the Clinton State Department and in the Obama administration, would say the problem with Hamas is that they did not pursue a course that's like the one in the broadest sense that you outlined, which is now let's, you know, let's govern, let's enjoy the fruits of our victory. They really did turn themselves into an opposition front in a fundamental way.
And, well, we spent
most of their time, you know, attacking and purging, you know, opposition elements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, when you don't give them the control they won in an election, yeah, you risk them resorting to violence, Bob.
Well, I'm
and that's a very different scenario.
I'm sure there's an element of that, and you know, we'll never know what they would have been if you could have given them everything you wanted to give them. But I guess I would say you have to entertain the possibility that there are people out there who don't want to be reconciled in that way.
There absolutely are, and it's a difficult business kind of severing them from Hamas in a very over a very long
process.
Let me
go back to Iran for a second. As part of a settlement, would you want to demand that Iran stop arming Hamas?
Wow, it would certainly be nice. It's a long, complicated question, and it gets at the question that Obama will face. Is the well? Here's a question for you. I mean, you hear that the big question is, you know, does a deal with Syria and Iran lead to peace in Palestine, or is it the other way around? One question I had is, why can't you pursue both? Is there a reason you can't pursue both tracks at once?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously you could pursue both tracks at once, and I think that, you know, I would assume that the new administration would be desirous of pursuing both tracks at once. But I find it interesting that we are talking about Syria right now more than anything else, and I just don't know whether that's because it's possible. I'm speculating here, but it's possible that someone like Dennis Ross may believe that, you know, lo and behold, the time is not exactly ripe for a breakthrough on the Israel-Palestine front, and that it's time to, you know, look at other fronts to see whether you can ease the process in that way.
Well, I think that's his view. I actually think the war with Hamas has maybe made a Syrian deal less likely. I think it's a little harder for Syria to be seen doing business with Israel now.
Well, but this is where we are now, but at some point this thing's going to end and you'll have some kind of arrangement. You know, we can look 2 months ahead or whatever it is, and you'd have a different environment. I don't think you should rule that out.
No, but I think the environment will be worse. I mean, what worries me most about this is, you know, if you look at the people who have been killed and maimed in Gaza, you know, and do the math and ask yourself, of course, you know, my constant worry is how many new terrorists you're creating. If you ask yourself how many people in Gaza can now say as a result of this war, okay, the Israelis killed my little brother or permanently disfigured my niece or kept my best friend from ever being an athlete again or whatever. If you ask yourself how many people can now say things like that, it's tens and tens of thousands, I think. And, you know, the total number of men under arms in Hamas was 20 to 40,000 or something?
Well, 15,000 is what I've heard.
You know, you've just replenished the entire army and then some. And that's, and I just think, you know, I realize that domestic politics drove Israel to do this or something like it, maybe almost inexorably, but I think that's a separate question from whether this was in Israel's long-term interest.
Well, I mean, again, it depends what the, you know, it's too soon to tell. It depends what the outcome of all this is. I mean, if the outcome is a serious weakening of Hamas, setting aside the rocket issue, that may be ultimately a strategic benefit.
Well, again, I just think there's been so many new terrorists created, so much propaganda value for Iran, some for Hezbollah. And, you know, it gets back to this point about you were saying, well, maybe you can't do something in Palestine now, you should deal with Syria instead. The problem is this kind of...
I wasn't saying that. I was just accepting
well,
that.
Well, okay, you think Dennis Ross is saying it. The problem is this kind of circularity of influence, okay? Like, the stronger... I mean, this war, it may weaken Hamas, but in the short term, may even destroy them. Although then you got to ask, what's coming next? I would suggest ultimately something equally radical. But meanwhile, it has strengthened you know, the people who support Hamas or will support the next radical movement in Gaza.
Well, that, you know, maybe yes and maybe no. Maybe it looks like Hamas made a mistake. I mean, who knows? I think you're jumping to unnecessary conclusions. And let's, after all, this isn't the first time we've had an ugly operation undertaken by Israel. This isn't the first war we've had. We've had previous wars, which are in fact much worse than this, which then led in a matter of a couple of 3 years to some kind of peace breakthrough, right?
Well,
I mean, that happens too.
What springs to my mind is a 1982 incursion in Lebanon where, yes, they got rid of Arafat, they chased Arafat out. Meanwhile, they created Hezbollah with that presence, and that's, I think, the thing to worry
about.
Well,
but look, this is in that part of the world, it's more true than it is normally, but it's always true that everything that you solve leads to three new problems. I mean, you know, we defeated Hitler and we got the Soviet Union. These things happen all the time. We kicked the Russians out of Afghanistan and we got the Afghanistan that we later had. I'm not sure that, you know, if you go by that logic, you pretty much would never do anything.
Well, actually, in the case of Afghanistan, yeah, I wish we had done nothing there. But
yeah, I know, although it would have been very hard to argue that at the time.
Yeah, I wasn't arguing it at the time, I admit that.
Yeah.
No, that would have been a hard blowback to foresee.
Yeah.
Are we ending on a note of agreement or something?
I think we've been substantially agreeing throughout this entire conversation.
Oh, well, then I must have made a mistake.
Or maybe I've just mischaracterized our conversation.
Well, it was certainly civil.
Well, it's always civil.
No, I think more civil.
I don't want to have
some
day when somebody asks you about an article I wrote that you'll say, well, I can't comment on that because Bob and I really...
We're not to that point yet. No, but if somebody asks you if you can comment on my book, you have to say no, because whenever I do, I caricature it.
Well, that's fair enough.
Which I've heard you do.
Caricature your book?
Yeah, last time around, you depicted me as a woolly-minded one-worlder, whereas I'm, in fact, a rigorous one-worlder.
A person as self-aware as I know you are cannot fail to know that if I caricatured you once, you caricatured me 20 times.
I would take that as a compliment.
Well, there you go. Let's leave it on that compliment, then.
Let's leave it on that another note of agreement. Okay.
A pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Let's do this again.
Take care.
Okay, see ya.